From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's show, I talk with Benjamin and Carol Weir. For 16 months, Reverend Benjamin Weir was held captive by the Islamic Jihad in Lebanon. The Weirs have just written a book titled Hostage Bound, Hostage Free. Also today, I'll speak with crime writer Anne Rule. Her books are character studies of sociopathic murderers. Film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new Brian De Palma movie, The Untouchables, and our rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new album by Pianosaurus, the band that plays rock and roll on toy instruments. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The first phase of the Iran-Contra hearings has given us a fuller picture of American efforts to free the hostages in Lebanon. The fate of my guests was bound up in that intrigue. On September 14th of 1985, Reverend Benjamin Weir was released by the Islamic Jihad after 16 months of captivity in Lebanon. He was one of three Americans released after secret American arms shipments to Iran. Carol Weir witnessed her husband's kidnapping but was powerless to stop it. The Weirs had worked in Lebanon for 30 years as Presbyterian missionaries. They spoke fluent Arabic and felt at ease with the Muslim culture. They regarded Beirut as their home and didn't want to leave, in spite of the dangers they risked in staying. After her husband's kidnapping, Carol Weir devoted herself to securing his freedom. The Weirs have written an account of their ordeal. It's titled Hostage Bound, Hostage Free, and it's published by Westminster Press. When I spoke to them, I asked Benjamin Weir to describe the moment he was kidnapped.
We had just stepped out of our apartment house, going toward the seminary just 10 minutes away. I was thinking about the meeting I was going to and hardly noticed that a car had stopped on the narrow street, but I did see a man come toward me, and I thought probably he was a stranger asking for directions and maybe speaking English. So I asked him, do you want something? He said, yes, I want you. I thought his English was all mixed up until he grabbed my arm and started pulling me toward the car. And that was, a sign to me that this was a kidnap attempt. I started yelling and resisting and trying to fight him off, but he was a lot bigger and stronger than I was and finally forced me into the back seat. And when I was seated and he next to me, then a man in the front turned around and pointed a pistol at me and said, get down on the floor. I realized at that moment there was no way to escape I could see, and that I really was being taken, and I had no idea what would happen. I was frightened and startled.
Benjamin Weir, they had you in the car, and you were all tied up. Describe what they did to you in the car.
Well, in the car, I was told and forced down onto the floor of the back seat, and then a piece of burlap or something was put over the top of me, but the man next to me in the back seat kept his hand right on my back so he knew every move I made. The car sped on and finally came to a halt. When it did, a bag was put over my head and I was led out of the car into a room. There I was made to lie down face down on a mattress, blindfolded, while hands went through my pockets, going through everything I had. And then I was turned over and felt tape being, and heard tape being stripped from a roll and felt it being wound around my ankles and up over my body with my hands pinned to my side, right to the top of my head, with just enough space to breathe through my nose. That was a frightening experience because I wasn't sure I could continue to breathe without having enough air passage, or I wondered what would happen if my nose passage should get clogged. I did ask for some water, and they gave me a sip of water through some kind of a funnel and then taped my mouth closed, though I was not gagged. And then I felt myself being lifted and put in a container and heard the lid close. and I was glad then that I could still breathe.
Did you ever ask your captors why they wanted you, why they kidnapped you?
Yes, I did. When I was taken, before I was completely taped, and the men said, for political reasons. I said, what political reasons? I'm not involved in any political activity. I'm a pastor. They said, well, you'll find out eventually. And that ambiguity continued for about 2 months.
And what did you find out about why they had taken you?
Well, at the end of 2 months, one day, a man came and said I was to write a letter. And he dictated in Arabic what I was to say, putting it in English. It was kind of a crazy letter because he gave it to me word by word and phrase by phrase so that it came out in kind of stilted, unnatural English. But before I got to the end of the letter, I realized this was a letter in which I was making an appeal to the Prince of Kuwait for release of men held there, and that what happened with them would happen with me. If they were released, I'd be released. If they were continued to be detained, I would. Or if they were killed, I'd be killed. That was a very sobering and frightening prospect. I really was very much surprised by it.
Carol, the burden was on you to do everything you humanly could to get your husband released, but this is not something people have a lot of experience with. Did you panic? Were you able to kind of keep yourself mentally organized enough to logically figure out what you should be doing?
Well, of course, I was very upset and really didn't know what to do. I went to my friends, to the seminary, where there were people who were supportive of me and helpful. I knew that I needed to go to the American Embassy to report what had happened. And I think that knowing I had to just proceed and do those things gave me the energy to follow through on them.
Did you call the press?
At first, I asked the Synod of Syrian Lebanon executive to make a statement to the press identifying who Ben was and the fact that we were related to that church activity. And at first I was very reluctant to go to the press. I had been told by embassy personnel not to go to the media, not to say much, and not to talk and so on. But then my friend said, maybe the persons who took Ben don't know who he is or what his work has been. And so then I did talk to the press and had an interview to identify him, what his work was, how we were related, what we were doing in the Middle East, what we were doing in Lebanon. And I think perhaps it was that article that identified for Ben's captors who he was and what his work was.
It seems that probably one of the key things you have to do if you are someone who has taken somebody hostage is to make sure that you don't empathize with them. Because if you empathize with them, if you really recognize their humanity, then you'd be overcome by guilt and would want to set them free. Were there ways that you realized that the captors were dehumanizing you so that they wouldn't have to face your humanity?
Well, I was kept isolated for 14 months and rarely had much in the way of conversation with my captors. There were a few occasions where that happened, but mostly conversation was very limited, was superficial, was related to a specific thing such as bringing food or taking me to the bathroom or some mechanical thing of that kind. And otherwise, their remarks were often silly, not really very much related to the real situation. Furthermore, they never wanted to be recognized and of course, I was never allowed to see them. I was always blindfolded in their presence. And from my side, I never really trusted them fully. I was rather reserved, especially at the beginning, so that there wasn't really very much interpersonal communication. And that was a real setback. I did very early hope that I might establish some kind of relationship with them, even in teaching them English, but that never really happened.
You weren't tortured.
No.
What were the most humiliating things, though, to suffer in captivity?
Well, there were a few occasions where I was really at risk. At one time, the first guard who was in charge of me for several weeks was very brusque and very controlling. He was very determined that I should not in any way even approach seeing him, and therefore insisted that I would always keep my blindfold on even when he was not present. On one occasion, I had been clearing my nose, and just when he unlocked the door, and as he came in, he found me settling my blindfold back in place, and he was very irate over that. He said, "I'm going to show you." So he went out. I could hear him taking his pistol out. I thought probably he was emptying the bullets, but I couldn't be sure. And when he came back in, he poked the barrel of the pistol under my chin, and he said, "I could very easily blow your head off." And he said, "You know what this means?" I said, "Yes, you're thinking about the fact that you could kill me." He said, "Yes, and don't forget it." He said, "I could easily kill you and throw your body out in the road. Nobody'd ever ask about it." I thought he was doing that only to scare me. I didn't really think he intended to kill me, but I realized the possibility was there. That was one frightening experience.
Yeah, it seems every time you peeked out of the window when you were told not to look out, or every time you took off a blindfold, every time you were told to leave it on, even though you were alone in the room, that you were risking some terrible punishment for
yes,
it. And it must
yes.
have been a really hard decision to make, whether
it was
worth the risk or not.
It was, but I finally came to the point of realizing I was willing to take that risk in order to just get some kind of sense of what the outside was like, as well as to get some idea of where I was being held. And I took that risk, knowing there was a real risk to it. But I felt it was worthwhile, and it certainly gave me some memories when I had seen a sunset or a sunrise, or in the middle of the night seen some stars, that, you know, it was an image I could carry with me through the rest of the day, and it meant a great deal to me.
What were some of the other things that you could think about or do to help you get through the day? I'd imagine that boredom and lack of any kind of mental stimulation is one of the worst things to face when you're being held hostage.
Very much so. I had been involved in enough pastoral counseling to know what depression does to someone, and I didn't want to fall into depression. So I felt from the very beginning I ought to try to take charge as much as I could and establish some kind of an agenda. I exercised regularly many different times during the day, partly just to use up the time. I also engaged in fantasy trips intentionally. I had birthday parties for my children or for family members. I wrote imaginary letters to them. I also regularly had times of meditation, trying to recall a specific Bible passage and to really study it and try to see what it had to say to me. Later on, when I finally, after 35 days, was given an Arabic New Testament, then I engaged in very serious study of Scripture and came up with a lot of new questions, as well as very meaningful passages that spoke to me.
Was your faith ever shaken?
I felt from the very first that my faith was very frail, and I didn't know how long I could last. I really felt that I needed to rely on God to give me a sense of trust and dependence on Him, and more relied upon the expectation and the promise that God gives His Holy Spirit to those who really ask and trust for it. And I felt that was true, that I was given resources beyond my own. In other ways, God made available to me resources within me that I was not aware of.
I'm surprised to hear you say that you thought that your faith was frail.
I think that probably is true for everyone in a desperate circumstance. I think it's only realistic to recognize it, and that as one of the passages of the New Testament presents it, when we are weak, then we begin to sense the strength of God. I think that's a very important human experience that comes to us again and again.
Carol Weir, when you first started trying to
talk with U.S. government officials about your husband's captivity. They told you to go for what, quiet diplomacy?
Well,
is that the word that they used?
Yes. Mm-hmm. They were using quiet diplomacy, and that the church's task was to pray, but that they were going ahead with quiet diplomacy. Yes, that's the phrase that was used most often with me.
Did you try that for a while to just, because they wanted you to not speak to the press a lot too, right? Wasn't that part of the quiet diplomacy?
Well, that's right. And I did decide that I would not go to the press. I informed our church people that they should not put anything in the press or go to the media or do a lot of talking and so on about Ben's situation. After a few months, I began to have some questions about that, though.
Why?
Well, I, for one thing, was continuing in contact with the embassy in Beirut, and I had no sense of progress on the case. The same language was being used with me over and over again. It takes a long time, and we're trying, and so on. But I didn't have a sense of any progress, and we met in Damascus because it wasn't safe for Americans to be traveling in Beirut. And we visited the American ambassador there. And I pressed him as to what our government was really doing for the release of Ben and the others. And his response to me was, "Have you been to Washington?" That and other clues made me realize that I probably needed to return to the United States and to be more active in Washington for Ben's release.
You tried to get an audience with President Reagan?
Yes, I did. I tried to get an appointment with him. I was told that he was too busy to see us.
Who were you able to speak with in the government?
We spoke with Richard Murphy, the Undersecretary of State for the Middle East, and we did get an appointment with Mr. Schultz, the Secretary of State. I talked with him, but I was rather discouraged after our meeting because, again, I had a sense of no progress, you know, a sense of helplessness. What do you expect us to do? What can we do in this situation? So I really had the sense that there was no one person, for example, who headed up the effort to get the men released, that the whole question was handled rather broadly in their efforts at counterterrorism. That was one reason I was discouraged. Another was that I was pressing them for contact with Kuwait about the prisoners that were being held there. And they said they would not interfere with another government, that was Kuwait's affair. And then I pressed them to be in touch with the men that held Ben and the others, and they said they would not deal with terrorists. So it seemed to me they were not really doing those things that I felt would unlock the issue and get the men out.
So you tried to take matters more into your own hands? To be more aggressive in campaigning for his freedom?
Yes, that's true. I decided that, along with our church people, that we would have our own campaign. And so I began to appear in the media. I discovered when I returned to the United States that not many people knew about the hostage affair, that it had been kept quiet. And I felt that the American people needed to know and that they would express compassion and that there would be a desire for the men to be released.
My guests are Reverend Benjamin Weir and Carol Weir. Benjamin Weir was a hostage in Lebanon taken by Shiite captors. He was hostage from May 8, 1984 to September 14th of 1985. Benjamin and Carol Weir have collaborated on a book about that hostage experience. It's titled Hostage Bound, Hostage Free. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
Reverend Benjamin Weir and Carol Weir are my guests. They've collaborated on a new book titled Hostage Bound, Hostage Free. Benjamin Weir, when you were released, How did they tell you that you were going to be set free?
Well, it happened very suddenly. One evening, the chief of the guards came to me and said, "We've decided you're going to go." I said to him, "I think Father Martin Jenko probably needs to be released more than I do because he has high blood pressure." But the chief of the guards would not even enter into any discussion of that. He said, "One of the guards will trim your beard, you'll take a shower, and you'll go." I had two reactions. One was, "Yes, I very much want to be free." The other was, "Oh God, what can I do in behalf of the other men? I couldn't think that I could do anything for them."
It's just hard to imagine this opportunity. Someone says, "Okay, you're going to be free," and you say, "No, no, no. I think Father Jenko, you should free him instead." What did you think, Carol, when you found out that your husband had almost objected to his own release and suggested somebody else should be released
upset.
Instead? Were you?
I was.
Well, she was angry. She didn't really like the idea at all.
Well, Ben had been held the longest, and we were, as hostage families, concerned together for all the men. And everything we did for Ben, we always said we intended and tried to make an effort for all the men to be freed. But if there was only one to be freed, I felt that Ben should be that one.
It must have been hard, I guess, to leave you. There were several other men who you had been in a room with.
It was
the
very
last
hard.
Part
we
of your
we
captivity.
Had been together for the better part of 2 months, and we had really become very, very close. There was barely opportunity for me to hug each of them in a very tearful way and to say goodbye. And then I was led out blindfold down the stairs to a car into the back seat and driven perhaps something like 20 or 25 minutes, and then told from the man in the front seat, "We're going to stop in a minute. When we do, you're to get right out, leave your blindfold behind, don't look back, and you'll know where you are." And that's the way it happened.
So where were you?
I was on a street in Beirut in the middle of the night. I knew where I was.
No one to meet you?
Oh,
no one there?
No, no. It was spooky. There was nobody on the street.
Did you ever think, "Oh, somebody else doesn't come and kidnap me while I'm trying to get home"?
No, I really didn't think of that, but I knew that, nobody's on the streets of Western Beirut at night.
It's dangerous.
It's dangerous. People have guns. There are firefights that can break out at a moment's notice. No, my thought was, somebody might just not know who's there and take a pot shot at him, and I could be that target.
But you made it. Where'd you go?
I really don't want to talk much about that, but I went to friends, and they put me in touch with the American Embassy.
Were you debriefed? Was there a period in which you were told what kind of information to give to the media and to the public?
No, there was nothing of that kind. But the following day, I agreed with a member of our program agency of our church to meet with people from the government, from State Department and others, for a series of sessions, and did. But early on that day, I received a phone call from a Navy operator who said the president was on Air Force One plane and would like to talk to me. And so I said, "Fine," and waited. He said, "You'll have to remember that there are some security regulations, and therefore you're not to address the president, but to use only his code name, which is Rawhide." And I thought that was strange and determined that I really wasn't going to do it because it really sounded pretty silly to me. Finally, the president came on the phone. He expressed his great thanks that I was free, his concern for the other hostages, his hope that there might still be others released, his hope that there would be no public announcement at this time. And I agreed that if that were for the safety and the hopeful release of other hostages, I certainly wanted that. So he pretty much continued. He was really carrying on the conversation. And finally, I realized I wasn't going to get a chance, so I broke in and said, "I have a message from my captors of two parts. One, that they expect the United States to put pressure on Kuwait for release of the 17 men held there. And secondly, they want you to know that they're ready to resolve this matter quietly, without publicity. I was surprised there was no response. The president, after the briefest of pauses, went on and finally said goodbye and hung up.
So he just stuck with his pre-written speech?
I thought maybe he was reading from a script. I couldn't tell, but it seemed that way.
What were your reactions when you found out that America had traded arms for hostages? And one of those arms shipments happened, was it a week or two before your release, Benjamin Weir?
I very much regret that there were arms involved, because for years I've been opposed to the arms escalation in the Middle East, as has our church, and know what the cost is of modern arms. I have known friends to be killed. I know what it is to be on the end of an artillery barrage, and I regret that this has added to the loss of life in the Iran-Iraqi war.
Carol Weir, do you feel slightly ambivalent about it, sharing your husband's feeling that it's unfortunate that there would be more arms in the Middle East now? But on the other hand, he's released.
Oh, well, I don't feel ambivalent at all. I feel angry. I believe that there's always an alternative to military intervention. And I believe the way to go is to negotiate. And that was what we as hostage families were trying to get our government to do. So it was a great disappointment.
The government, Sienna, is that if you negotiate with hostage takers, then you're legitimizing them and you're making it more worth it for future groups to take people as hostages.
Well, in fact, they made a deal. They made a deal with Iran. That was never the demand of the group. They never asked for weapons. They never asked for ransom. What they wanted was prisoner exchange.
This is a painful thing to bring up, but I know you lost your 24-year-old daughter after your release, and she was killed in a bus accident, a train collided with the bus. It seems like more than any family should be put through, and I just can't imagine if the hostage period didn't shake your faith, what happened to your faith after a short time afterwards your daughter was taken away?
Well, that was a great loss, and I'm still in mourning for her. I think I have struggled with that, and there are no good answers. I realize that we as Christians are not entitled to special treatment, actually. We are subject to the accidents and the problems and the tragedies that occur to everyone, to anyone, and have prayed that that I would have the courage and strength to bear that loss.
It's been the hardest thing we have ever faced. And in the midst of it, two things have come to me. It doesn't take away the loss, but one is that God suffers with us in that loss, and secondly, we are greatly blessed by the support of a Christian community that understands and really shares with us in that loss.
Okay, I want to thank you both very much for talking
thank
with
you.
Us.
You're welcome.
My guests have been Benjamin and Carol Weir. They recount Reverend Benjamin Weir's captivity in Lebanon and Carol's efforts to free him in their book, Hostage Bound, Hostage Free. It's published by Westminster Press. This is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll talk with playwrights Larry Kramer and William Hoffman. Their plays The Normal Heart and As Is explore how AIDS and the fear of AIDS are affecting not only sexual relations, but all relationships. So I hope you can join us. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, policewoman turned crime writer Anne Rule talks about her latest book, Small Sacrifices, the true story of a woman who shot her three children. Also today, film critic Stephen Schiff reviews The Untouchables, Brian De Palma's film about Al Capone and Elliot Ness fighting for control of Chicago in the 1930s. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Pianosaurus, a new band that plays toy instruments, and we'll check in with National Public Radio in Washington for the latest news. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Here's the news. This is Fresh Air. In a time when most rock and roll groups spend thousands of dollars on state-of-the-art synthesizers and sound systems, there's a band called Pianosaurus that uses nothing but toy instruments. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of their new album.
I don't know that some of you have been appalled at having rock and roll played on your public radio station when I pop up here once a week. I know that a few people think it's a communist plot. Garrison Keillor announces he's leaving a Prairie Home Companion, and the first thing you know, they're playing Prince on National Public Radio, right? You don't like rock and roll because it's too loud, because you can't understand the words, or when you can, they're very rude words indeed. Well, I'm going to give you a vacation from all that this week. There's a trio called Pianosaurus. For about 4 years, they've been making rock and roll on toy instruments, little plastic pianos and little balsa wood guitars, a cardboard drum kit with a picture of the Smurfs on it. The result is quiet by rock standards, yet it is true to the spirit of rock and roll. This is Pianosaurus and Bubblegum Music. That was Pianosaurus from their new album, Groovy Neighborhood. I've never heard any other band play toy instruments, but believe it or not, there is a tradition that this music can be linked to. Pianosaurus alludes to it in the song I just played, Bubblegum Music. That's also the name of a 70s pop music genre that included groups like the 1910 Fruit Gum Company, Harper's Bazaar, and the Archies. Their music was simple, cheerful stuff, with lyrics that were banal whenever they weren't vaguely risque. Anyone out there remember the immortal, "Yummy, yummy, yummy, I got love in my tummy"? There are other precedents as well. A 60s group like Herman's Hermits, those thoroughly domesticated mop tops, sang "Mrs. Brown, You've Got a Lovely Daughter," a song you can easily imagine Pianosaurus performing. In the 70s and 80s, Jonathan Richman has made a fetish out of low-volume rock, creating songs like "Rockin' Rollin' Leprechauns" and "Party in the Woods Tonight," rock music for children. Acts like Pianosaurus, however harmless they seem on the surface, are actually pretty brave, because they court contempt from people who want to write off rock and roll as infantile junk anyway. What I find appealing about Pianosaurus is that, while making music that could be created by a few inspired members of Romper Room, they sing smart, tinkling little songs about broken hearts and passionate crushes. Sort of grown-up stuff.
Rock critic Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer.
Ready to rock. That's what I like. Fat and tall, I'm in a spot. No need to talk when you're ready to rock. From the Eiffel Tower to the Champs-Élysées, from the Palace Hotel to Avenue A. No need to talk when you're ready to rock.
You're listening to Fresh Air. My guest is crime writer Anne Rule. She's a former policewoman who has been writing about crime for the past 19 years. She's written articles and books about the personality of the sociopathic killer. She wrote about serial murderer Ted Bundy in her book The Stranger Beside Me. Her new book is called Small Sacrifices. It's the story of Diane Downs, who was convicted of plotting to murder and then shooting her three children. One died, another suffered a stroke, and her four-year-old son was left paralyzed from the waist down. On the night of the shooting, Downs drove to a hospital emergency room with her children, and there accused a mysterious, shaggy-haired stranger of attacking the family on a deserted road. The hospital workers didn't fully believe her story. Anne Rule told me why.
Well, that first night, May 19th, 1983, the workers at the hospital found Diane's behavior inappropriate. They had dealt with a lot of parents who had lost their children or relatives and had seen, encountered grief before. And Diane made jokes. She seemed more concerned about the bullet holes in her car than she was about her children, who'd all been shot in the chest. Laughed inappropriately. They weren't sure that night. They thought perhaps the mother was in such profound shock that that was the reason for her behavior. But later on, of course, this behavior continued, and then suspicions really arose.
One of the things I found especially frightening, one of the nurses, I think it was, described how Diane Downs was leaning over her daughter as her daughter was in the hospital bed. The daughter was attached to a heart response monitor. And as the mother touched her daughter and said, "I love you, dear," the heart response monitor registered, what, fear?
Yeah, that was Christy, and Christy, her heart was beating 104 beats a minute, which is high anyway, but of course she was desperately injured and had had a stroke because of the loss of blood. And looking into her mother's eyes, the heart rate went up to 147 and stayed there for half an hour after Diane left the room.
The real question this brings to mind to everybody is, how could a mother shoot her own children? Why would a mother shoot her own children? What was the motive that was uncovered?
Long term, Diane had been a victim of incest, was suffering from histrionic, sociopathic, and narcissistic personality disorders, all of which meant that all of her attention was focused upon Diane, upon herself. She deserved to get what she wanted when she wanted it. Immediately, Diane was in love with a married man in Arizona, and she had tried everything to wrest him away from his wife. When nothing worked, she decided she would quit her job at the post office in Chandler, Arizona, go to Eugene, Oregon, and she thought for sure that Lou couldn't let her go, that he would have to follow her. She was only in Oregon a few weeks when she realized he wasn't coming. He was refusing her letters and her phone calls. Diane made a trip back to Chandler, Arizona, confronted Lou, and the last words he said to her were, "Diane, I'm not coming to Oregon. I don't want to be a daddy." With those words, that started in motion her terrible plan. It upsets me every time I say it, but the way Diane thinks was that if her children weren't around, she wouldn't have children, then Lou wouldn't have to be a daddy. 3 weeks later, her children had been shot. Cheryl, 7 years old, was dead. Christy was 8, shot in the lungs. Danny, at 3, shot in the spinal column and left paralyzed from the chest down. She really seems to have thought Lou would come back to her.
Her daughter, her surviving daughter, testified against her.
Christy, yes.
Yeah, in the courtroom. Were you in the courtroom?
Yes.
Can you describe what it was like when Diane Downs' surviving daughter took the witness stand to testify against her mother?
Christy was 9 years old, and she had had a stroke the day after the shooting because all of her blood had been replaced, and replacement blood does not have the oxygen-carrying properties that our own blood does. It had taken 9 months for Christy to be able to speak clearly, and more than that, to bring that memory up, because if you're an adult, you don't want to remember anything horrible as that. Christy didn't want to consciously look at the memory of her mother shooting her. Fred Hughey, who was the prosecutor who was assigned the case, worked with her to try to make her feel secure in the courtroom. But even so, it was a terrifying moment. Christy was carrying her paralyzed arm and her good arm, and she sat down, looked at her mother, and pulled herself together. And Fred asked her, he built up to it slowly, and then he said, "Who shot you? What happened?" And she said, "Mom stopped the car. She went to the trunk. She came back with a gun. She leaned over the seat." And at this point, Christy started to sob, and they had to stop for a minute. And she said, "Then she shot Cheryl. She shot Danny, and she shot me." And at that point, everybody was crying in the courtroom, the jury, the gallery, the press row, even Diane, who rarely cried, had tears in her eyes, and Christy sobbed. But that was the watershed point in the trial. There was no disbelieving that little girl.
What was the expression on Diane Downs' face when she was found guilty?
That was 3 minutes after midnight on Father's Day, 1984, and the jury had been out for 3.5 days. And the press row I was sitting in, we were so uptight that the whole row was just trembling. Diane was the only person in the courtroom who was smiling. She didn't cry until she got into the paddy wagon to go back to jail. For Diane, it is more embarrassing to cry in public than it is to tell, as she did on the witness stand, the most intimate details of her myriad affairs with married men.
Diane Downs' 2 surviving children were adopted after the trial by the prosecuting attorney, the lawyer who prosecuted Diane Downs. Why did he adopt the children?
Well, for the simplest of reasons, he loves them. Fred Hughey is a very private man. He bonded with those children. The detective who was in the room with him, the first time he saw them, he went to the ICU to see the children the morning after the shooting, and they were being kept alive by machines. And Fred is a very stoic man who rarely reveals his feelings in public. Paul Alton, the investigator, looked over, and he was amazed to see tears running down Fred's face. And he told me, this was years ago, he said, in that moment, Fred adopted, quote, adopted those children. Fred worked with Christie, he had to prepare her for the courtroom. After the verdict, Fred and his wife, Joanne, who had been married 20 years but had no children of their own, had the kids for weekends, took them skiing, tried to help the foster parents show these children that there were adults that they could trust in the world. And last summer, it was the most natural thing in the world for Fred and Joanne Hughey to adopt Christie and Danny. And it's the happiest ending to one of the most tragic stories I have ever researched.
Do you ever worry that your books about killers make the killers into heroes or heroines?
No, because my books don't. My books annoy them because I show that soft underbelly, the weakness. Diane is furious about the book I've written, Small Sacrifices, about her. I guess I've yet to write about a killer who was pleased with the book. Ted Bundy, who I knew and wrote about in The Stranger Beside Me, has finally forgiven me as he faces the electric chair now and started writing to me again. Randy Woodfield, known as the I-5 Killer, was the subject of my last book. Randy is now suing me for $12 million because he says I ruined his reputation by writing about him after he was convicted of murder, attempted murder, rape, sodomy, and robbery. I don't think any killer would ever want me to write a book about them because they don't come out as the heroine. They come out as monsters.
Anne Rule, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Anne Rule is the author of Small Sacrifices. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of the news on today's All Things Considered. Renee Montaigne, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What stories are you following today?
Well, tonight from Venice, we'll have a report and analysis on President Reagan's news conference, the news conference he gave this morning. We also report on censorship in Nicaragua. The government shut down the main opposition newspaper, La Prensa, last year. Now, the independent newspaper that supports the Sandinista government is also experiencing censorship. From Colorado, we'll be having a story on a small mountain of tires, some 6 million tires that are burning there.
What else is coming up on the show? Who will you be speaking with?
Well, I spoke with author Dayton Duncan, who traces the path of explorers Lewis and Clark in his book Out West, an American Journal.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. In the 1930s, federal agent Elliot Ness took on gangster Al Capone in Chicago. Ness told his story in a book called The Untouchables. In the late 50s and early 60s, Robert Stack starred as Ness in the TV series The Untouchables. The new movie The Untouchables isn't based on the TV series. It draws directly from Ness's book. Our film critic Stephen Schiff has this review.
There's a film critic's term I hate to use because it sounds so pretentious, mise en scène. It's French, of course, and it literally means the placement of things in the scene. People, doorways, guns, what have you. The only reason I'm bringing it up is to differentiate the terrific things in The Untouchables from the lousy things. You see, Brian De Palma, the film's director, is a master of mise-en-scène. In other words, he knows everything about what you should see in a shot and how you should see it. The Untouchables is full of gripping, exuberantly directed action scenes, including the already famous one in which De Palma takes off on the classic Odessa steppe sequence from Potemkin. But the other half of a director's job is getting great performances out of the actors, and that's where De Palma has trouble. He can make suspense build and violence explode, but he can't get two people to sit in a room and have a convincing conversation. Obsession, he understands. Irony, he understands. Anything larger than life, he understands. But simple, affectionate relationships throw him for a loop. And that's why all the movie's characters fall flat. The story, as I'm sure you know, is about how the Treasury agent Elliot Ness cleaned up gangland Chicago and put Al Capone in jail. And the movie has a great Capone in Robert De Niro, who is very much larger than life, a boisterously public figure, half mayor, half Lord High Executioner.
I'm going to tell you something. Somebody messes with me, I'm going to mess with him. Somebody steals from me, I'm going to say you stole, not talk to him for spitting on the sidewalk.
Right.
You understand?
Mr. Capone!
I tell you one more thing. You got an all-out prize fight, you wait till the fight's over, one guy's left standing, and that's how you know who won.
But Elliot Ness is supposed to be Johnny Cleancut. He has a wife and kid, and the movie's family scenes are the sort of goopy Norman Rockwell fantasies that leave you waiting for the punchline, which never comes. The screenwriter, David Mamet, has given Elliot Ness such stilted dialogue that it's hard to imagine who could have spouted it convincingly. The star of the film, Kevin Costner, never comes close.
The truth of the case is that the man Capone is a killer and he will go free. There is only one way to deal with such men, and that is hunt them down. I have forsworn myself. I have broken every law I swore to defend. I have become what I beheld, and I am content that I have done right. Now, that man must be stopped, and you must...
I'll be the judge of what I must do, Mr. Ness.
You see what I mean? And that leaves Sean Connery, who gives a real live-wire performance in the hackneyed role of Elliot Ness's mentor. The whole screenplay, in fact, is awfully old hat. In telling the story of the innocent good guy who has to learn how to play dirty in order to tame a tough town, Mamet is giving us reruns of clichés we remember from old westerns, and he's doing it without conviction. I didn't believe a moment of The Untouchables, but that doesn't mean I didn't enjoy it. When De Palma gets all the elements swirling in a shoot-'em-up or a suspense sequence, mere mise-en-scène seems like entertainment enough.
Stephen Schiff is critic-at-large for Vanity Fair. Here's a preview of our next program. On our next show, I'll speak with Jill Godmillow. She directed the film Waiting for the Moon, a fictional account of the relationship between Gertrude Stein and Alice B. Toklas. It's the next presentation of American Playhouse on PBS. Also, folk singer Michael Cooney will share some fresh versions of old pop songs, and critic at large Laurie Stone will review Talk Radio, the new play by performance artist Eric Bogosian. So I hope you can join us. And we'd like to hear from you. Write to us with your comments and suggestions. Our address is Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. That's WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty is the production assistant. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Fresh Air's theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.